Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to, I think, the first program in the spring of 2016. We're just 85 days away from summer solstice. I think we've done rather well. So I'm aiming at the 20th of June at 6:34 in the afternoon around here. Who knows? That's funny, I don't notice the tilt of the earth. You know, it's, by that date, the North Pole is pointing, you know, right at the sun. We're tilted off center, 23.4 degrees. Yeah. Hard to believe things happen so gently when you're part of something so huge. Interesting program today. I think we've got, this is some of the things we notice about Freemasonry. Not so much the working. Not so much the workings, but of us, the people that are Freemasonry. Freemasonry is has the history that is enormously rich in philosophy and ethics and the revelation. And it's interesting today that we're talking about like this. Because it is Easter, isn't it? For some people, it's absolutely Easter. And we've passed the high Christian holiday, the Good Friday. I'm a deist, but I'm not going to do anything but celebrate with all of the faithful, whatever it does for you, as a practicing Christian or a person of faith, to Pesh, the resurrections and the festival, and it's a festival, a celebration of the resurrection of the prophet Jesus, and it occurred on the third day. Of his burial after he was killed in 30 AD. Rich in symbolism, rich in allegory, metaphor, and rich in a story that is compelling. And if we can be controlled enough to search for that, I think that the story tells us more about a journey. That the same thing that the same thing, not the same man, not the same condition, but the same story that every major faith in the world contains. It's remarkable. This is the 27th day of March. This is only the 86th day of the year. It hardly leaves anything left. It's only 279 days. I want to talk to you about things bittersweet, but today's commentary is the bittersweet effect. A little bit of, let's bring us together into a similar frame of mind. Here, just a little taste of spring. Yeah, I had to. It just fits this time of year. It wasn't the first. He picked up the theme, did this Vivaldi, and it was his most successful piece, The Four Seasons. But The Four Seasons had been written, the story had been written, the music, by I believe it was an Italian, Garaldi, but correct me here. You know, hearing a good thing and times being what they were, our friend Vivaldi, Antonio, wrote it in his own way. And the original, you know, is interesting. You can see that there were certainly the idea was so beautifully constructed. And it was wonderful for him. It was relatively straightforward for him to pick up the seasons, because you can do so much with it, you know? And you can do so much with it musically. And that's what it's all about. Let's get back to the store here. I'm compelled to talk to you about things that I noticed again. The world is in the usual state of dynamic, in flux. It's not dynamic flux, that's redundant. it's in a state of change, ever forming. We are facing a time when there's a considerable amount of dishonesty. Leaders don't speak honestly. They speak with cynicism and some political agenda, almost to a fault. There's an agenda. What's changed isn't so much, I think, the nature of leadership, but the communication of those ideas and the examination. We can hear examine the work, the decisions, and listen to the voice of major leaders from around the world, from the comfort of our own home, at our discretion. So it's not that we're being necessarily massaged into a mindset. We have analysis of the psychological purposefulness of retailers. They're guiding us to products. And when we hear about these things, and then, you know, you and I might be of an age where we're thinking that we do have this sense that we're being constantly hounded by retailers, because that is their lifeblood. And we live in a culture that doesn't so much champion the education of individuals, but the profit, the capacity to make profit off others. But profit, you know, obviously doesn't just come from thin air. It's on others. So it preys heavily on the weak-minded and unprepared and uneducated, on impulsive people. And some of us are just magpies. You put some shininess around it and a novel little bit of music, and we have to have it. Lineups for products is really quite astounding. People would sit outside for overnight waiting for a new cell phone to come up. The competition, that need to be somebody. On one hand, a wiser man might be thinking of the purpose of his life, needing to not to waste that time, but to be productive and useful. And then who determines what's productive and useful but him, against what standard? And when we listen to, we read, if we look at Alexander Pope's life, we could say, well, yeah, there is some merit there. If you look at Graham's life, you might say, well, he was in earnest most of the time. Yeah, for sure. Then there's these people that I felt a great connection with many years ago when I was a young student. People that could seem to have capture the purpose of life without leaving a heavy heel marks behind, that were able to live their life with the softest footprint, to leave the least amount of damage behind. Did I say damage? The connection was with probably that notion that most people, some people would find very hard to reconcile. That those the folks that believe that there is one course, that's to use the resources of the environment in to create profit. Those people we tend to call conservatives, and they have they seem to struggle quite a bit with the notion that not all profit is necessary. It's and not all profit is beneficial. And when I think about it, we're facing the calculators are out. The volcanologists are doing their calculations, and they're saying that there's some things about the Earth that are scads old. The time, it's not a matter of if these apocalyptic events are going to happen, but when. The one closest to me is here, where I sit, is the super volcano that rests underneath Yellowstone Park in the United States. Duh. that the calculations are when it first erupted, created that nuclear winter. The blocking out the sun. If that happens, we'll see. We think about that. It sort of, for me, it underscores the importance of making the best use of every opportunity, every day, enjoying the sunshine. You know, life is far too short and unpredictable to spend a life complaining about every ache and pain and problem and being preoccupied with the fact that all of these things are undeserved. Well, yeah, they are. There is a bittersweetness in life. And I think for Freemasons, not to walk around your lodges using this type of thing, but when you sit down to contemplate, when you're in a comfortable chair like you are now, put me on hold and go and grab a cup of your favorite beverage, if that's a good cup of tea or something a little more exotic, maybe that whiskey that you've been saving, or that port. I don't know where you are. Or like me, right now I'm sitting here with this lovely French roast. Those are the moments when we need to be able to, we want to be able to let our thoughts examine. Here, it sort of goes like this. The future has always been a great treasure house of meaning. Got your attention tonight. I know. I have to work hard for your attention some days. People everywhere, dissatisfied with naked experience, have clothed the present with signs of things to come. They have found clues in the lives of sacrificial animals, in the flight of birds, in the movement of the planets, in their own dreams and sneezes. The saga of the prophets records efforts to cease being the victim of the gods' whims by deciphering divine intentions in advance toward becoming an independent, self-conscious self, freely choosing beliefs. The Mesopotamians experimented with ways to force from the present the secrets of the future. Diviners watched smoke curling up from burning incense. They interpreted the figures on clay dice to give a name to the coming year. They answered questions about the future by pouring oil into a bowl of water held on their lap and noting its movement on the surface or toward the rim. Hebrew scriptures leave traces of how they too sensed the divine intention and gave today's experience the iridescence of tomorrow. Jacob dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham thy father, and the God of Isaac. The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give, and to thee thy seed. And the chief priest used the Urim and Thummim, sacred stones carried in his breastplate. These gave the divine answer by whether the yes or the no stone was first drawn out. David consulted such an oracle manipulated by the priest Abiathar before going into battle against Saul. When the yes stone appeared, forecasting his victory over the Philistines, he advanced in battle. A man who was now called a prophet, or Nabi, we read in the book of Samuel, was formerly called a seer. The seer was one who saw the future, and his influence came from his power to predict. The priest predictor who admitted his clients into the intentions of the gods was held in awe when his predictions came true. The prophet had a different kind of power. He was a Nabi, proclaimer or announcer, and spoke with the awesome authority of God himself. So the ancient Hebrew prophets opened the way to belief, I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, declared the Lord. I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I shall command him. Deuteronomy 18:18. They used the word mouth and nabi interchangeably. Our English prophet, from the Greek, a speaker before or for, carries the same message. While the seer forecast how events would turn out, the prophet prescribed what men should believe and how they should behave. In ancient Israel, the first two roles were not always easily distinguished. But seers, mere forecasters, came to be displaced by prophets, touched by the divinity for whom they spoke. It was this transformed role that opened the way to the discovery of belief, toward the self-consciousness that awakened people to their freedom to choose and their responsibilities for choice. The history of ancient Hebrew prophecy is a saga of this unfolding self. The seers, adept at interpreting signs and omens, sometimes drew on their own dreams and visions of ghosts and spirits for sights of the future. When the founding prophet Moses spoke to the Pharaoh, he spoke for God. Thus said Yahweh. And it was through the prophets that God governed his people. When the prophet brought no mere blueprint of the future, but the commandments of God, he offered a new test of the believer, the test of obedience. The first five commandments, prohibiting the worship of alien gods, forbidding idolatry and blasphemy, commanding observance of the Sabbath and honor to parents, affirmed the traditions of their society. But the remaining five, all cast in the negative, prohibiting murder, adultery, theft, false testifying, and coveting of neighbors' goods, emphasize the freedom of the hearer to choose a way of right belief and so avoid sin. The Ten Commandments thus made obedience the mark of the believer. But another distinctive element of the Mosaic religion would open the gateways of belief. The intimate God of Moses had mysteriously shared powers with his creatures. He even treated his people as his equals by covenanting with them. The supreme paradox was that this all-powerful creator God sought a voluntary relationship with his creatures. And the relation between God and his chosen people was to be freely chosen on both sides. If you listen to these commandments and obey them faithfully, then the Lord your God will continue to keep his covenant with you and will show you his covenant constant love, as he promised your ancestors. This particular covenant relationship between God and his creatures proclaimed God's preference for a freely given obedience. This signaled the divine intention that man's life should be ruled by his choices and was the historic Hebrew affirmation of free will. About the 8th century BC, the oracles of the Hebrew prophets were written down by the prophets and their scribes. Then the prophets assumed a role beyond the community where they lived, to whom God had first addressed his message. Thus, writing expanded tribal revelations into a world religion. And such a transformation had occurred before, when the utterance of Zarathustra, the second late millennium BC, became the foundations of Zoroastrianism. It would occur later, too, with the recording of the words of Jesus, and then with the utterance of Muhammad, may peace be with him, in the 7th century. The prophetic movement that set Western thought on the path of belief and choice began around 750 BC and would last about 500 years. It brought no mere commandments, but a call to faith. The great Hebrew prophets who opened paths to belief were a varied breed. They could be described as amateurs, for most were not priests. While their utterances had no authentic seal of a sacred profession, each had been called in his own way, and so had his own vocation, a personal invitation to speak for God. The words of the first of this line of classical Hebrew prophets to be preserved in writing were no longer directed only to the king. They already aimed at a wider audience. Masons, you'll know these names. Amos was an orator directly addressing a whole people. "I am not the kind of prophet who prophesies for pay," Amos explained. "I am a herdsman and I take care of fig trees. But the Lord took me from my work as a shepherd and ordered me to come and prophesy to his people." That's Amos 7. He preached in a time of prosperity, when the wealthy lived in luxury and the poor were oppressed and overtaxed. Religion, he complained, had become mere ritual. He spoke for social justice and the simple faith of Yahweh. In the book of Amos, we hear God's terrifying judgment and foresee its destruction by fire and famine if its people do not repent. The last of the great prophets, Ezekiel, deported by his conquerors, had carried the message of faith in Yahweh and personal responsibility. The fall of Jerusalem in 587 BC and the destruction of the temple were the fate of idolatry. Only the choice of Yahweh and not the merit of the people made for a special people. The freedom, the choice, not the following, not the commands, but we see from that period an analysis, an understanding of the need for us to be accountable to ourselves for the decisions that we make. And we wonder, how do we do that? Is it a simple black and white world because I want it to be? Because that's consistent with everything that I know. So that's what crept up on me and made me think about bittersweet effect. I want to talk to you about that. Here's a voice that will help bring us to that point. Her name is Haley Lauren.
The wind raps on my window pane, reminding me of you again. As I watch the dying flame to the night, an autumn song in shades of blue resonates with sounds of you. Thank you. you shelter from the storm. The cozy fire to keep you warm. But most of all, when snowflakes fall, I wish you love.
My, oh my, oh my. It's nice. It's a nice wish. But be careful, it's all a setup. Here, I want you to focus on this before I get into my commentary. Our Western culture has seen three grand epochs of seeking. I speak to the travelers out there. You know who you are. First was the heroic way of prophets and philosophers seeking salvation or truth from God above or the reason within each of us. I just went over that a little bit, just a sample. Then came an age of communal seeking, pursuing civilization in the liberal spirit. And then most recently, the third, an age of social sciences, when oriented toward the future, man seems ruled by forces of history. Wait, is this blasphemy? Are we saying that all people are Masons? There's a bit of Mason in everybody? And then most recently, the age of social sciences, when oriented toward the future, man seems ruled by forces of history. We draw on all these ways in our personal search. They still speak to us, not so much for their answers as for their ways of asking the questions. Is this long quest Western culture has turned it from seeking the end or purpose to seeking causes, from the why to the how? Might this empty meaning from our human experience? Then how can we recapture and enrich our sense of purpose? Western culture, instead of seeking the end or purpose, to seeking causes, from the why to the how, the cause. Broken dreams. I think that Freemasonry has a responsibility to admit that it appeals to dreamers. Oh my, can you hear people heading for the door? When did we get this notion that dreamers don't produce, that dreamers aren't hardworking, dedicated, committed? When? That's just somebody's ego explaining that anybody is a dreamer because I can't dream. It must be wrong or daft. If you've stopped dreaming, well, that's too bad. A sigh that emanates from him in those quiet moments. It takes maturity to gently look life in the eye. Gently, the gentle craft. Our antiquarians deconstruct Freemasonry. We're looking for the how, aren't we? We step back in time following threads of ethics and principles. Each period in history is a watershed of its own. Must a thoughtful man distinguish the merit of an idea from the period in time when values were not as urbane as they are today? There is a downside to misogyny and intolerance, to hegemony and hubris, but that hasn't erased those influences from conscience. Oh, they're still here. Projecting a sense of indifference to major cultural themes doesn't give us a chance to speak to them. Some people put themselves in a rigid position, all Freemasonry can offer in response to reason, the choice. Some minds never open. Some minds become unstable because unless the illusion of order is unchallenged. If we thought Freemasonry was immune to self-examination, that would be wrong, wouldn't it? Freemasonry is, I would argue, a unifying theory. In itself, it adds another more inclusive level to an all monotheistic faiths and forms of politic. It is dreaming to imagine a brotherhood based, is it dreaming to imagine a brotherhood based on common beliefs? Is that dreaming? Shame on anyone who repudiates the objective study of any belief system, including Freemasonry. Like life itself, Freemasonry can be as simple or as nuanced as one needs it to be. This simple statement has been missing. That oversight explains a great deal about the state of our union. Maybe bittersweet has more irony in it than we thought. Maybe. What I'm saying is that Freemasonry is part of a natural order, a grander order. Now, where do you stand in the movement between the why and the how? Is it something that has any bearing on Freemasonry? It might, if you apply it, just might. But the idea of the bittersweet, it's that realization that comes with age. When things didn't necessarily work out the way that you had hoped, the bitterness, but the sweetness is it was really, really good while it lasted. All of the good things in life, do they seem transient? They come and they go. Maybe the psyche is all riddled with this notion that we're sitting on top of this great magma, just ready to look for these vents that are going to just launch hundreds of thousands of tons of material up into the atmosphere. So do we spend our time now looking over our shoulder? Are they called preparators? You know, people that are in their bunker with as much fresh water as they can store and, you know, convince themselves that there's a certain amount that's enough. I don't know if I want to be the last one here to shut out the lights if everything is just apocalyptic, but to tell you the truth, I don't walk around in that sense of dread. Do you? I walk around with a sense, a Masonic sense perhaps, a sense of purpose with objectives around me. To be able to do things for people without them knowing that it came from me. That, you know, darn you, Freemasonry, you ruined an idiot. I was perfectly happy thinking that a charity was a handout to, and that the people that got it should be bloody grateful, you know, that, you know, because I had some, and it was made me feel good because I had a little more that I could share. The tithing, you know, I didn't need to be told that. Some do. You know, they actually resent poverty. No, it was more that Freemasonry brought that under a microscope, and I had to examine it, and I had to agree that, you know, made sense. And I quickly went from that, you know, the act of charity that has that hubris in it, and arrogance about it, you know. Here, you know, consider yourself lucky. You're getting a turkey on Christmas. undeserved though you are because of your circumstance. You know, you've led yourself into that lifestyle on purpose. It's your fault. Really? That is simply mean. What Freemasonry did was then explain something about this sense of charity being a benefit to the giver. That satisfaction of doing something for another human being. Not because they're akin, but because they're of their humanness and of the need. And to be able to do it without the person knowing, that's, in my mind, the lightest footprint. The lightest footprint. Now, I know there are a couple of people listening to this program that will already have identified me as having aspects of sour grapes. Shakespeare just made sure we remembered to be, you know, immortalized, the notion of sour grapes. And now I'll try and find the play that he used to tell us all about that. But I think it is, there's a groundswell of people, like-minded people, that feel a respect for Mother Earth. In the way that the great Suzuki teaches us, the air, the water, the land, we matter. Without that, this notion of us prancing around air-conditioned malls, without a care in the world about the effect it's having on the environment, is leading us to ruination, inescapable. We can't, he worries about the collective conscience. And should we all be more generous in our thinking about the world around us and the other people? I despair at the Occupy movement. I don't know if we can exonerate our cultures from this obscenity where a few people in the face of the earth have amassed so much wealth in a stark reality of starvation. People having nothing. My goodness. It's when good men step forward, good people step forward to bring about a sense of, to express a sense of hope, a sense of the unfinished journey moving forward. Here, we are using our study of history, the sciences, to tell us in a way about the future. Tell us about what we can do to contribute. I don't think that I expect somebody to come in with their bank account to a lodge meeting and wipe it out and say, there, I've done my tithing. I'm now going to live a monastic existence. I don't expect that. And I don't expect that I'm going to necessarily see evidence of commitment by people showing up and attending and things like that. No. What I don't know, that is based on faith, my belief, is that the notions of Freemasonry are being conveyed around the globe, everywhere, in every aspect of a Freemason's life. I guess I'm thinking that you can be dutiful in your belief without necessarily being among the dutiful, without attending a temple or church. You're you're part of the Kirk, huh? One Kirk, the people. So we have a range of effects. Some I think are very important and necessary, where we show good deeds. We roll up our sleeves and we're pulling together fundraising, and we're, you know, we're giving it to those needy children. You know, there's some language that I find really quite offensive, and when I hear us doing that, or, you know, it's like it just creeps me out. There's no dignity in it, and after a while, if we own up to it, it's thoughtless. But we do it so readily, don't we? I find that hard to do anything about it except to lead by your being, to live it by example, to be gentle and respectful of our fellow man. But we're a work in progress, and perhaps that's the finest purpose of Masonic order. We never have to be at the end of that trail, the end of the journey. And some are doggedly resistant to searching out places in the mind that they haven't been before. And some are just, you know, pain in the ass and quite unpleasant to be around. But they are part of us. And we have that potential for change. And you think if we're going to live up to the aspects of our character as Masons, it's really quite a remarkable lifestyle that we live. Just quite amazing. You know, Freemasonry over the years, over the centuries, has been the wish, has conveyed the dreams of so many really excellent people. I'm just thinking the task of the antiquarian was to bring back into the light that ignorance had shrouded in decay. So think of it metaphorically here. I'm talking about Stuckley. We remember that name, don't we? He accepted the image of the old charges of the primal knowledge inscribed in two columns built to survive deluges of flood and fire. And he says, the origin of the mysteries, as we hinted before, is no other than the first corruption of true religion. When they first began to deviate from the patriarchal religion into idolatry and superstition. And this was nigh as early as the renovation of mankind after the Noahic deluge. The Diluvian, Noah, where only the cleansed existed. It will be, Stuckley believed that the Druids had possessed the fragment of the primeval patriarchal religion. He said the Druids had possessed it, and which he had hoped to rediscover in the secrets of Freemasonry. It will be first inquired what was the intent, the inducement of their initiation into these mysteries. The answer will be, he said, they learnt thereby taciturnity, or the art of keeping a secret, a thing of great use in the political part of life. They learnt to cultivate an inviolable friendship. They learnt morality, and at length, a sublimer notion of religion than the rest of the world enjoyed. The friendship hereby sealed among the initiated took a sacred and inviolable character. They were brothers ever after. Stuckley was initiated in January 1721. In June, the Duke of Montague became Grand Master, and that would well account for the reference to what Stuckley regarded as an ill-fated recruitment drive. The serious question here would seem to be what was it precisely that constituted the folly of the members referred to by Stuckley? But June 1721 to June 1723 was one of the most tumultuous and difficult periods in Freemasonry's entire history. It was a period that later generations of Freemasonry would hear little of. We don't want to talk about that. We have to admit things we do. And those that knew what had happened and whose purposes were threatened by it would very much like to forget it. Its stunning vividness has been buried in time, heaped over in saccharine myths like the events related to Martin Scorsese's astonishing recreation of 1840s America, Gangs of New York. The period of tumult effectively ended significantly with the publication of Anderson's Constitutions in 1723. Once published, official minutes would begin to be kept, and the first secretary to Grand Lodge would be elected, perhaps after the Scottish model, perhaps. Of course it was after the Scottish model. The first secretary to Grand Lodge was William Cowper. Cowper was clerk of the parliaments, a government official who ran his Masonic business from his government office. But naturally, he batted for the Whig cause. Under the government of George I, if you were not a Whig, you were out of power. He's a practical boy there, Cowper. As if to preempt the first constitutions of Anderson, which came out in January 1722, Freemason J. Roberts, about whom nothing else is known, published another set of constitutions known as the Roberts Print. Significantly, Roberts repeated a charge from a copy of the old charges dated from the 1660s, now held by the United Grand Lodge of England. It is quite possible that the manuscript represented the deliberations of an assembly of Masons believed to have been held both by Roberts and Anderson in 1663. The relevant charge stipulated that a properly constituted lodge must contain at least 5 accepted brethren and a minimum of 1 brother who was an active member of the trade. Incidentally, this is also consistent with the account given by Ashmole of his mother lodge at Warrington in 1646, where John Ellum was almost certainly the statutory working Mason. But hey, I gotta go. I gotta get out of here. We've got things to do. Sun's coming up. It's been a pleasure to have you join us here again. Always is. I'd like to bounce some of these ideas off you and get some feedback. You can reach me at MasonicEffects, all one word, @gmail.com. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness and take good care of one another. See ya. Thank you.
Thank you.